So a few organizational things. There's much more I could teach, which I like to, on the Vajrasattva, especially the what's called the confession, which is the four great antidotes. So I would like to have a class on that. It's really important. So it's profound, it's deep, it's extraordinary. But what I'm planning is class this morning, and someone is going, I'm going to ask someone to lead an evening session of the Padmasattva, the Guru Rinpoche Yab Yom. And then tomorrow is going to be no class, it's just a full day of practice. And on the next auspicious day, somewhere midweek, maybe Wednesday or Thursday, the empowerment of Dorje Drolo, another manifestation of Guru Rinpoche, which is considered a very secret form, very wrathful form. So that's coming up. We'll prepare for that, and I'll prepare for that now that we have the text translated. That's good. Okay, so that's the current plan. Great. Well, let's begin with the preliminaries. I'm just wondering if Michael over there looks like you're at home.
Do you hear me?
Yes. Is the sound full yet? Would you like Michael to take a turn there?
Yeah. We can hear you, Michael.
Go for it, Michael. You just have to belt it out a little bit.
Very good. Very good.
Okay. It's wonderful to have someone in Switzerland being our chant master. It's wonderful. That's great.
The four thoughts that turn the mind from samsara.
Sending beings equal space, hope for refuge to the root source of blessings.
We go for refuge to the enemy's sword, Supreme City. We go for refuge to the king, the speller of all obstacles. We go for refuge to the Buddha, the first among humans. We go for refuge to the sublime Dharma, peaceful and free from attachment. We go for refuge to the Sangha, the supreme field of accumulation. We go for refuge to the Dharma Palas, the masses, and our activities. Namo, from now until the attainment of unsurpassed awakening, I and all the ascended beings equal to space go for refuge to the Guru's eternal blessings. We go for refuge to the Yinam, bestower of supreme city. We go for refuge to the Dakini, dispeller of all obstacles. We go for refuge to the Buddha, the first among humans. We go for refuge to the sublime Dharma, peaceful and free from attachment. We go for refuge to the Sangha, the supreme field of accumulation. We go for refuge to the Dharma Palas, masters of activity. Generating bodhicitta. Nyaya korve sanje dukkha dukkha jim eva tuma numa viraga yunda tam yom nam te sanjungi chanjur nipo to chita gike nagi rodu sanje gunda jir sanje attain the stage of Buddhahood in this very lifetime. Therefore, we will be ready to live in some past teaching, the path of the wounds and the fear of Bhagavatam. May all sentient beings of samsara be free from suffering, be joyful and truly abide in supreme happiness. We generate the supreme mind impartial towards all in order to attain the power of awakening. In order that we may fully benefit the beings of the six realms, we must attain the stage of Buddhahood in this very lifetime. Therefore, we will be very diligent in this unsurpassed teaching. The path of the loom is the clear body of essence. 100 syllable Vajra Sutra Mantra.
Yoya Om Vendra Sato Samaya Manupalaya Vendra Sato Teno Patishto Drido Vibhava Sutto kaya me bava, supo kaya me bava, anurakto me bava, sarva siddhi me kaya cha, sarva karma sucham me chitam shriyam kuruham, ahaho bhagavam, sarva tathagata vanjama me mulcha, Nindri Bhavam Mahasamaya Sato Om Nindra Sato Samaya Manupalaya Nindra Sato Venopatishto Griro Me Bhava Sutto Kayo Me Bhava Sutto Kayo Me Bhava Anurakto Me Bhava Sarva Siddhi Me Prayacha Sarva Karma Sucham Me Chitam Shriyam Kuruham Aho Bhagavam Sarva Tathagata Indra Mame Muncha Indri Bhavam Mahasamaya Sato Sato Samaya Manupalaya Vendra Sato Venopatishto Drido Me Bhava Sutto Kayo Me Bhava Sutto Kayo Me Bhava Anurakto Me Bhava Sarva Siri Me Gayacha Sarva Karma Sucham Me Jitam Shriyam Kuru Aho Bhagavam Sarva Tathagata Vendra Mame Muncha
short mandala offering.
So a question here on, just going to go through this question fairly briefly, which for many will be a bit of an esoteric point, but important to others. Could you clarify the apparent conflict where it's one line says obstacles from the Dakinis to your attaining meditation, and another line that says in the refuge prayer, the Dakini is a speller of obstacles. So if you are not destined or don't have the karma for revealing treasures or transmissions, or you're entering into practices and things that one doesn't have the authorization or one doesn't have the mental preparation capacity for, it is said that you will be prevented from doing so by the Dakinis that protect those teachings and transmissions. Whereas Dakinis are very much there to remove obstacles. So not only is the Dakini principle of the so-called female enlightened energy principle there to remove all your obstacles along the path of liberation, especially tantric practices and so on, and accomplishment of the siddhis, but they will, if you're in the wrong frame of mind and the wrong karmic conditions and so on, they will then create terrible obstacles for you. So they have a mercurial aspect, wonderfully helping and wonderfully in the way. Okay. That's the whoever wrote that.
I think
question.
It was Patricia Butts.
Oh, Patricia Butts. Hello, Patricia Butts. Different, so-called different Patricia, same and different. Okay, so that's the very, very short response to that question. Let's turn to page, whatever page that is, number, I think it's number 18 we're on, of the Bodhicitta Vivarana. So some of this teaching here today on appearance emptiness and the breakdown of the concepts around solidity and entity, we're entering into the Chittamatra view, the great practitioners of yoga, of Buddhist practitioners of yoga in ancient India, or also sometimes called mind only. We're entering into that with really number 22. But much of this I covered last night in pith form, just direct teaching on the nature of emptiness and appearance. But here we're going to go through it step by step by step, and you can take on these meditations, these contemplations, as you wish, step by step. You know, it's absolutely fantastic in retreat, like a month or two or three or four, five, 6 month retreat, to have the time and space where your mind is really lucid, and then take these contemplations on all day long. What actually is it that I'm experiencing? When I look at a door frame, why do I call it a door frame? Just stay with it, and you'll see eventually there's going to be an extraordinary transformation. So. Number 18, page 3. Through division in terms of spatial dimensions, even the atom is seen as possessing parts. That which is analyzed in terms of parts, how can it logically be an indivisible atom? So in ancient India, like in ancient Greece, the idea of the atom as the end point of form and matter was actually commonly taught. There's texts from 3,000 years ago. Matter of fact, I've seen them, which are amazing descriptions from India of atomic structure, of molecular structure. But in those days, the atom was it. That was the atom. That's as far as you go. But later on, after the Buddha's death, people started questioning atomic theory and saying, well, if it's an entity, then it must have parts. Well, that actually wasn't discovered until about 1880. It's interesting, eh? By Western science. Atoms became again mainstream in the 16th, 17th, 18th century, referring back to Greek texts. It was logical, it made sense. Chemistry was indicating there's such things, but it was only really around 1880, 1890 with Crookes who discovered the electron and then eventually discovered the neutron and proton and so on, and discovered that no, atoms aren't solid entities, they actually have parts, and then lo and behold, they're not things, they're mostly space. And then lo and behold, they're not really things at all and space, they're really energy fields and probability fields of spatial energy. So this is extremely modern. This is quite something. They're saying if there's an atom, there's going to be parts of atoms. And there will be, anything as an entity must be described by spatial dimensions. Just think about that for a sec. The only way you can describe it is to make a grid, a three-dimensional grid, and place it in time and space. We do that all the time with people, by the way. Everything we do, we automatically categorize things in terms of time and place without knowing we do it. Everybody in the room has been actually placed without, as soon as you come into the room, and now with memory, you know where everybody's supposed to sit. So there's a map of everybody in the room to about a square centimeter before you walk in the room. So everybody's placed in a dimensional framework of space. Every teacup, everything in the room is already in memory to a small fraction of a centimeter. Yeah. So every entity, just like an atom, can be located and mapped spatially. So he's saying then that if that's the case, logically, analytically, how can there be such a thing as an individual atom? So he's taken that away. Now this is huge. This is like someone walking into Greek life, like Socrates is saying, there's no atoms, folks. That's a construct of your mind. Huh? So now the most indivisible thing in the universe has been taken away as not indivisible. Number 19, with respect to a single external object. And by the way, some of these verses are pages and pages and pages of detailed logical explanations in ancient texts and modern philosophical texts. If you want a reference to an amazing book, I think he's really quite an amazingly wonderful scholar practitioner, is Jeffrey Westerhoff from the UK. He's not only classically trained in Western philosophy, but he's also a Buddhist practitioner, and he has studied especially Nagarjuna and the tradition of Eastern philosophy at an extraordinary depth, and has one of the best ways of explaining all of this. So he's produced books on Nagarjuna, but he has a wonderful little pithy book, something like Introduction to Reality. It's a beautiful, absolutely beautiful book. And in it he has a section on exactly that verse number 18, which goes on for pages. And it's really something. You just see how deep he goes and how deep the philosophical text went into understanding the end point of indivisibility and how it can't actually truly exist. Fantastic.
What was his name again?
Jeffrey Westerhoff. That's correct, I think, Westerhoff. British philosopher, but he's a specialist in Nagarjuna, and he's extremely well versed in physics and very well versed in Western philosophy. So any of his books are a real joy to read. Some of them are very thick going, you have to take your time, and others are a little bit lighter. And also he's written a book which I've given an entire month or 5 weeks of teaching on, is called The 12 Examples of Illusion. That's the title. An absolutely beautiful, glorious book. Beautiful you can use it as a meditation text. We did. For teaching, especially the 12 Examples of Illusion, Illusory Body Meditation, we spent 5 weeks going through the 12 Examples of Illusion, especially the Mirror Meditation. And I think it's a significant book. It's a wonderful book. With respect to a single external object, divergent perceptions can arise. A form that is beautiful to someone, for someone else, it is something else. Is that fairly straightforward? Does anybody want to discuss that or have me discuss that at all? I think everybody gets that, yes? At one moment, a form can be utterly beautiful. The next moment it can be utter repulsively disgusting, depending on the frame of view. If you look at a beautiful tanka, yes, you go up to a painting, a religious painting like Guru Rinpoche, you go up to from 10 feet away, it's absolutely beautiful, or 5 feet, and you go, that's just exquisite. You go closer and closer and you see paint flaking and spots in there, and I was like, gosh, it's not very well painted. Actually, that one is, but that's a very unusual. It is. It's a very unusual style by an exceptional painter. And it's actually mineral pigments, which is really rare today. All mineral pigments. Anyways, so you go up to it, and you begin to the apparent mind. It doesn't change, but the states change depending on your point of view. Yeah. So there is no such thing as. He's now refuted the idea, which is very Greek and also in some places of Indian philosophy is very real. There is intrinsic beauty, there is intrinsic ugliness. Even in the Abhidhamma, there is things that are good, things that are bad. He's just taken that away and said, no such thing. So from the point of view of some of the schools of Eastern Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist tradition, some things are bad. Alcohol's bad. I know some Buddhists say coffee's bad. You should never drink coffee. Never touch a drop of wine, it's bad. Shouldn't even go around women. And women should never touch a pagoda or a stupa, shouldn't be able to work on it. It's bad, especially if they're menstruating. Bad news. Bad, 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 bad. Yeah? So all through schools of even Dharma, there are things that are bad things, there are things that are good things. There's good objects, bad objects. Good beings, bad beings. He's just taken that away. It's not even possible. Not even in the remotest possibly possible. No such thing. However, you can have relatively good states and relatively unwholesome states, correct? And if something's pleasing to you, we use the conventional term beautiful. Bellissimo. Yeah? Bellissimo. Beautiful, beautiful. But it's conventional. Has no real ultimate meaning at all. It, like the pagoda right now. If you stand away from the pagoda from about 15, 20 feet, gosh, it looks finished, it looks clean, right? Looks all done, all ready. Go up, go this far away, go, wow, there's a pit there, and there's a crack there, and it's chipping over here, you see? And if you took a microscope or a 10-power loop, 10-power magnifying glass, you go, oh my God, when are we ever, see God there, oh, when are we ever going to get finished? And go further with an electron microscope, and you go, it's never going to end. Cracks, pits, fissures. You see? So it depends on the reference point. So when you take this as a contemplation, how do you take this as a contemplation? It's very easy. Throughout the day and throughout days, you say, I'm going to work on the arising of that view of beautiful or unbeautiful, good and bad, and all these things, and catch myself at it, and listen to myself, and see if there's actually a reality or a concreteness and a validity to it. That's how you practice. You listen to yourself, you listen to others, and it's not that you go, you can't say beautiful, but you listen to it like an echo. And you go, is there anything actually here? Why have I taken that point of view to say it's beautiful? You may use the word, but do you see the relative and the absolute at the same time? That's the key. Number 20. With respect to the same female body, so he's using beautiful up there, referencing it to the female body. So remember, most of the time Nagarjuna would be teaching to monks. Just remember that, in monastic universities. That's mostly where he lived and taught. And this is very much directed to the monastic, and it's very much directed to Southeast Asian ancient monastic tradition. With respect to the same female body, three different notions are entertained by the ascetic, the lustful, and a wild dog. As a corpse, an object of lust or food. So from the point of view of an aesthetic Buddhist or even non-Buddhist practitioner, to remove the greed, to remove the lust and the greed out of the attraction of a beautiful female object. Of course, we know from this point of view that women never have this issue with men, right? So isn't that right? Women, you can, this is correct, right? Would never arise. It would be a handsome or a beautiful man. You don't have that issue, right? In anything, so you're free of this. Is that correct? Okay. So this is a little monastic. It's also a little ancient Eastern centered, as probably still taught as a truth today. Anyways, so let's take this as the same for females. So with respect to the same male body or the same anything, whatever it is, dogs, cats, giraffes, doesn't matter what it is, paintings. With respect to the same female-male body, three different notions are attained. So for the aesthetic who's practicing the Asubha meditations or trying to remove their greed states, how do they do that? A classic practice is you look at a human being, a beautiful female form, and you see them as dead. You see them just as skin and bones. Taking away the lust. Yeah? Why? Because what is it when we look at people? What are we seeing? What's 95%, 98% of what we see in another human being at any given time? A living human being. Dead cells. They're not living, actually. We don't see living cells, we see dead cells. But we project that they're living. Dead, except for the root tip. Skin, most of the surface skin cells are all dead, they're flaking off. Millions, millions and millions per day, just flaking off. Yeah? So what's living tissue in a human being?
Eyeballs,
most of the eyeball surface. Some of the fresh tissue on the tongue, because it gets replaced quite quickly. And that's about it. Dead. Isn't that cool? So here we are looking at, oh, look at that living being. They're animated, therefore we say they're living. So anyways, one of the great meditations that is taught in Southeast Asia among many Buddhist schools is to take away the lust, is to see what you're seeing truthfully, which is skin, flesh, bones. You're looking at material. You're looking at physical objects that you're imputing or projecting to be beautiful or ugly and so on. So that is an aesthetic practice, especially by monastics, especially. And then the lustful. So there it says, an object of lust. And then the wild dog may look at a human being and go, food. So it's showing that for three different beings, and by the way, it might be a mad human being saying food, a cannibal, yeah? Cannibal, food. Looking at people and going, food, wow, great, can't wait. Chicken, kind of tastes like chicken. That's what I understand, humans taste like a bit like chicken. I've never tried it, but chicken. So it could be. Can you then think or contemplate other ways in which you may see people? How do other beings today, and maybe even ancient times, see other beings and people? As what? Devices, tools, instruments, slaves, objects, right? Somebody might marry somebody or get together because they make really good millet or something like that, you know? Or they're wealthy. Or you get together because you feel safe, you know, whatever it is. So the projection onto another being is not necessarily the being, but it is a projection. It's not just ugly, it's not just beautiful, it's not just kind, but full sphere of all kinds of projections. So what's your obligation as a practitioner? Is to be able to get those either on a piece of paper or see them very clearly. And this is why we do deep retreat work. Has anybody in deep retreat work had that come up to them face to face, which is like, why do I do that? It's just completely nonsensical projection. Have you had that? 20, 30 times? 40 times? 100 times? And you go, this is nuts. This is absolute nuts. There's nothing there at all that I'm seeing that's actually quite true. So this is where it's getting, this is where it's going. So this is the logical, obvious refutation that there is such a thing as beautiful or not, and that if you try to do it as an aesthetic, you're actually being negative towards the object, right? So it's an antidote, but it's actually not a, it has its issues. Number 21, here we go. Now we're beginning to dip our toe into the famous yogic philosophical tradition called Chittamatra, or sometimes translated as mind only. 21. It's the sameness of the object that functions, if one asserts it that way. Is this not like being harmed in a dream? Between the dream and wakeful state, there is no difference, insofar as the functioning of things is concerned. So this is very, very deep, this point. Diesel or gasoline generator. Is a generator when it's not generating? And yet it has the word generator on it.
Just a label.
Right. So when do we call it when do we actually officially call it a generator?
When it's generating.
Exactly. If a human being is not animated, is it a human being?
No.
It's then called a corpse, yes?
Or food.
So as Yogi MC Kelsang Rinpoche once said, the only difference between a live person and a dead person is a great charnel ground meditator. Grew up in charnel grounds. That's where he was born. The only difference between a dead person and a live person is one's breathing and one isn't. That's it. It's great. This is really spend all your days with corpses, right? As a kid? Hanging around corpses? Only one difference. I never forget that. Only one difference. They're either breathing or not breathing. Yeah, fantastic. Well, he's a great yogi. Yeah. So, the animation, the function that something does, gives life to the concept, conceptual framework.
Can you explain what they mean by sameness? What I don't understand how they're using that.
The sameness of objects has to do with the function. It's actually a little clearer in some other translations, if I recall. So, when we ascribe meaning to an object, a thing, a person, a place, we're ascribing meaning. When it says function, what it really means is causal relation. What's the causal relation? Okay? So how we define things is by causality. What a thing does, right? So caste system. What does your family do? They are butchers. What does your family do? They are bakers. So by function, you have meaning. By activity. So that's very much what it means. So is it the same activity or a different activity? So a different translation to this, it is not the causal power of the, is not the causal power of this same thing, like something that may harm us in our dreams. Well, I'll get to that. Here's another, it's the sameness of the object that functions. Is this not like being harmed in a dream? And things are efficacious, our activity can produce results, causal production results, due to being like objects. Is it not like offense while dreaming? So there's whole bunches of meaning to this. So here we go. When it comes to function, to causality, is there any difference between the functioning, the apparent functioning in this so-called daily reality and in a dream? That's what the point is here. Can you see? Let's try this. Is the apparent object of what's called a generator, let's say it's a Honda, I don't know what it is here, it doesn't matter, a Honda 7000i generator. Can you all imagine that you see a Honda 7000i generator sitting in a dream? Okay? Is that any different than having your eyes open during the day and seeing a Honda 7000i generator? Can you see any difference whatsoever? Okay. Have we established that? That visually, auditorily, sensing, that if it is the object, there's not a shred of difference between daytime and dreaming. How's that? Let's just sit with that for a second. This is one of the most important points of Chitta Mantra, kind of realization. Can you, do you still believe that this waking experience is fundamentally different, and you're clinging to this as something different than when you dream? So the object's not different. Okay. Is the function different? Let's try it. Can you have a generator operating in a dream? Can you be sleeping and go, wow, they turned on, that's right, in the dream, the water, the electricity will be turned off this morning. And at the main house, they've turned on the generator. Then you wake up and go, I hear a generator. Is there any difference between the functioning, the causality in a dream, or the causality in waking? Can you think of any examples? This is the point here.
Sorry, I didn't know if you were asking a question.
I am. I just want to see if anybody's got an exception. Yes.
The great yogis, of course, would disagree with this statement, but I would say that in a dream, I can go fly if I want to, right? But here I am limited, maybe self-limiting, by the cause of gravity, which produces the effect of me not being able to fly.
Or the lack of wings.
Or the lack of wings. Or the lack of propulsion.
But you can fly.
I know
you can fly.
Go on an airplane and...
No, you can actually get up on a glider. You can actually, with your mind, you can build an ultralight. You can build a glider, and you can go flying. And we know with today, and they tried it hundreds of years ago. They weren't so successful. But different countries, different places, ancients tried putting on wings and flying. And today, people can fly by just putting on wings. They're beautiful. Have you ever seen those bat wings that people do, and they just leap off cliffs? And they fly today. It's quite something.
To stick with the original example of the dream versus this, in my dream, I don't need any of those things. I can just, you know, maybe on a good night or once every 30 years or something, I can go do that. But I've never flown here. And it does seem impossible.
I just don't see your it seems, so there it goes. It
it's
seems impossible.
What you're saying.
Well, yeah, and keeping in mind too that I'm also stating the great yogis would disagree with this, because there's lots of references in text that human beings fly. So it's my own self-limiting according to these. But yeah, I would be limited by the law of physics, to your point.
But by experience, see, the point of Dharma, always remember this, the point of Dharma is to remove suffering. So we're talking about your experience. It could be that in the future, with the right things, human beings can fly. They will be able to fly. Then likely will be able to fly. So the point is, by function, is there anything that you can't do in a dream that you can do here? So you're saying you can't fly, but others can have been known to fly.
But could you say, in terms of this argument, in a dream the generator comes on, but you wake up, you physically get up and turn the light, and there's no light.
But how do you know that you're not waking up here? It's
terms of reference.
It's terms of reference.
Yeah,
so you can wake up in a dream, and you can wake up in this dream. Many people have woken up in this dream. Really woken up in this dream. And also we know with in modern neurophysiology that all everybody is dreaming all through the day. They just don't know it. They're having rapid eye movement all through the day, and they're actually dreaming. One of the signs of becoming more and more awake is you just don't dream during the day. It stops. There's just no fantasy during the day. It's a very good measure of awakening. Is that the fantasy level goes down, 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 until there's just no need at all for any fantasy whatsoever.
But you still have the generator on.
Which is, are you dreaming the generator? Or are you, is a generator on? Where's the generator on? So let's come down to function. where is the generator on for our experiment? Remember Dharma. If you want to find out physics, physics doesn't liberate. Chemistry doesn't liberate. What liberates is experience. So what's happening in experience right now? Is there a generator or is there a sound?
It's just a sound.
Is there a memory of a sound like a generator?
Mm-hmm.
That's all. And therefore we say generator because we have a memory of a generator-like sound. Dream or no dream? Does it feel like a dream? Yes. So the more this gap between wake and dream begins to fall apart, not just by logical argument, but by direct experience, then one actually does not see any difference, shred of difference at all, between dreaming and being awake. An awake is an awake dream. We do the same. So in other words, here's the key point of Chittamatta. We do the same thing in a dream as we do during the waking. We ascribe meaning to entities that aren't there. That's the key point.
Can you say that again?
Well, we do the same thing in a dream that we do in waking life. We ascribe meaning and reality to appearances that aren't truly there, and that is the point of the Chitta Mantras, and that's why it liberates. That's it. We're doing exactly the same function that we do in dreams as we're doing right now. We see things, we hear things, and we ascribe external phenomena when it's an internal mental phenomena ascribed by concept. There is no generator. There's simply the ascribing of a certain sound, which we could generate from a tape. I've known someone who got, because I saw it. Did it happen in the hill? Did it happen at Tara Cabin? No, it happened somewhere else. The sound of a hummingbird outside of a screened porch was interpreted as a bee, and since they were so scared of bees, they literally had a panic attack by hearing a hummingbird and said, get rid of that bee. Get rid of that bee, says hummingbird. Get rid of that bee. They were having a waking dream. And they were having a panic attack by just hearing the sound of a hummingbird. So what is that sound?
Be flat.
Good. And another concept, yes?
Sure.
Okay, are you getting the idea? Now, for some, it's very difficult to do because we have been taught from a very early age there is a dream, which is a reality, is a thing, and there is a waking reality. But it's a real hard one, so you really have to work at it. Most people have to really work at it until there's an experience of the inseparability of experience and phenomena as an inseparable experience. And then when you dream, you experience no shred of difference in terms of how this functions between a dream and a waking life. So for instance, what would you say to something as crazy as an iPad or a cell phone 150 years ago? Person's just dreaming, right?
Witchcraft,
dreaming. How about airplanes? 300 years ago, airplanes. Sorcery. Things flying in the air, million people flying every day around the planet. What do you think?
Sorcery.
Time to burn them at the stake. They're dreaming, they're mad. Electric generator, 200 years ago? Well, actually almost, well, no, just about. 300, 400 years ago, an electric generator that can power a house and you can run a water pump and all those kinds, and run an espresso machine. Espresso machine, are you kidding? An espresso machine 250 years ago? Whoa. Electric grinders? Beyond belief. All dreaming. All dreams. Dreams, dreams, dreams. How about now? So things that we thought were dreams and preposterous ideas, 203, when you say, humans are never going to fly, of course they're going to fly. Humans are never going to do teleportation. Of course they're going to do teleportation. They're already working on it. We're not only able now to teleport atoms, there's some scientists that can actually now teleport molecules. they're going after it, believe me. Teleportation will happen. It's theoretically possible, yes.
Is there a way meditatively to tell whether your senses are functioning externally or internally?
Is there any such thing as internally or externally?
Well, there is an inner so-called waking experience that we have consequences for the type of judgments that we make.
Beautiful, wonderful, no such thing. So how do we get to that? Where is all experience, internal or external?
Internal, or neither, because it's a distinction.
Good for you. Listen up there, that's great. On a relative level, where is all experience happening? In the dreaming mind, during the day and during the night. There is no real sensory experience, all interpreted by momentary consciousness. No such thing. So, shall we demonstrate this? Let's demonstrate it. Jeff, if you could reach out. Well, you're not supposed to. That's the thing. Okay. Yeah. Okay, Jeff. Do you see that fabric, possibly Guatemalan fabric in front of you? That red fabric, something like that. Laurel, no. Guatemalan, which Chiticastenango village, yeah. Good. Talk about an incredible map in there, all the villages. If you could touch that now and tell us what that is.
Warm.
So is it a fabric from Guatemala or is it warm? Which one is it?
My finger says it's warm.
Is it a fabric from Guatemala?
Could be,
but you don't know, do you?
No.
If you're being honest with the room, if you're being honest, Steve, is it warm or is it a fabric from Guatemala? And is it even a fabric? What's the experience? See, this is the thing with Dharma. What is your experience is where the point of liberation, not what someone else told you it is. So
it's jumping all over the place.
Pardon?
It's jumping all over the place, my experience.
Could you have that in a dream?
Absolutely.
Okay, can you have warm in a dream?
I think so.
Okay. Where's that experience happening? Is it happening in your fingertip?
No, it's happening in my brain.
Okay, so is the experience internal or external?
Both.
Why is it both?
Because if I didn't have a finger to touch this, I wouldn't be having that experience.
Oh, this is so lovely. I'm enjoying it so much. This is beautiful. Is your finger internal or external to your experience? Is your finger connected to your brain?
Yes.
Is there any separation between your finger and your brain?
No.
Is your finger external or internal to your experience? You've been told it's external.
It's the sense door.
You've been
to the experience.
But where's the sense door?
Ultimately, it's in my mind.
Exactly. Thank you. Proven. If you were to take many medical or people trained in physiology and say, where's the experience? They'll say, it's in my finger. Even though they're trained, it's not. Do it all the time. I've done that in rooms. Just say, go touch that and say, where do you feel? It's in my finger. And I say, is it in your brain? Oh, no, it's not in my brain. Well, where's the separation? So how can you tell right now you're not dreaming?
That's my question.
Can't.
Not a shred.
Can't tell.
If you're flying right now, Travis is flying right now, can you tell it's a dream or not a dream? Not at all.
Can't tell. I am flying.
Yeah.
Through space.
Yeah. And you're being hurtled through space at an incredible speed, happen to be on so-called on a planet, hurtling through space. Flying through space, and are you actually touching the ground? No. You're not neither touching the ground nor not touching the ground. So, can you fly for a few moments? Anybody ever did something crazy? I did as a kid. I used to fly all the time in dreams and things. It was just normal, even go like this and fly. Well, one day I was standing on the top of our banister in our house, our long staircase going down, and I just left off. I just, it wasn't really any difference for me about kind of flying, sitting in school, you know. And dreaming, flying. So one day I just stood there and went, great, I feel like I can just take off now. I did fly for a fraction of a second until I came crashing down. So can you fly? Could you, if we had a nice big cliff there, could you fly for a little while?
Oh, yeah.
It's called free fall, right? It's called free fall. There you go. And can you go like this in free fall?
Totally.
And act like a bird?
Sure.
Yeah? So we can fly. So, okay. So is this not like being harmed in, can we all be harmed in dream?
In our mind, yes.
Yes. Can we be harmed in wakeful periods? Yes? How about pain? Let's say you're cut by a knife. Have any of you ever been cut by a knife and went, oh, God, oh, and had the experience, or the other experience, which just look at it and you see the blood pouring out and there's no ow at all. It's just fascinating. Ever had that? Isn't that cool? Can you have that in a dream? Yeah. So, between the dream and wakeful state, there is no difference insofar as the functioning of things is concerned. Now, that's going to be demolished because people, that's the same argument, see? So the argument will be, if the functioning's different in dream. I can tell I'm dreaming because the functioning's different. The things that one can do is different. We can turn on a generator, but in a dream we don't turn on a generator, right? We imagine we turn a generator. That's the normal argument. So he does this every time. Sets up an argument, then demolishes it. Because he's going to take a position which you'd find in a monastic debate and say, but the function, the causality is different. Look, the generator to dream never caused the lights to go on in the house. We were never able to cook breakfast and flush the toilet because the generator of the dream doesn't do that. Is that correct? Wrong. Okay, so he's setting up an argument, and now he's going to tear it away. Yes. What do you think? Do you think that a dream, as some people say, doesn't produce future effects, or would you say it can produce future effects?
I would say it can produce future effects.
So would I. Yes, dreams clearly can produce future effects. Why? Why would a dream produce a future effect?
Because you can still take action in the dream. You can still make decisions based on what you believe to be true in the dream.
Right. So if you're flying, and then in a dream you go, but I'm not supposed to fly. What happens sometimes in a dream? Whee! Crash. You see? But look at how the dreams can affect future outcomes in the waking dream by believing them to be real. So the point here is that by believing things to be real, one creates karma. The belief in reality, of entityness as reality, actually produces the karmic consequences. Because you're actually investing in activity, you're investing in outcomes. All right, number 22, the official beginning of Chittamatra, although I think 21 is very much there. Okay, I want to go back again, because there's a point in the Chittamatra process that's really important, and I think it's really important experientially. Do you feel that things cause you to do things? This is important. Are you still at the place where the kettle burnt my hand? This is a really crucial point, both in development of a human, like the developmental stage of a human, but also as a an awakening being. Let me give you an example. I just think of these things come up. I think this will work. Do you still have the experience that the bell was lovely and actually made me feel better, and the bell irritated me? Did the object do it to me, or is it the imagination that is doing it? This is very important for dreaming. So for the awake dream, I am, listen to the language, I am being subject to by the objects and the function of those objects. I am being subject to, just like in a dream. Is that the case? What would happen if you woke up out of that and realized it's all mind and mind projection, how you are? How you are is mind projection. Then you may say, but I got sick due to a virus. But not everybody gets sick due to a virus. Some people never get Ebola. Some people never get HIV. Some people never will get COVID. Why? Okay. So this is an important point. Let you consider that. Are actors doing things to you and making you do things, like a puppet master? Yeah. Can you give me an example of where an object would do something to you, to your mind? Give me an example. Something where the object or the action does something to your mind.
When people drive loud cars, I get annoyed.
Great. So what's being annoyed?
It's a conditioned response to a phenomenon that it isn't actually real. My annoyance is my own doing by believing that sound is real. It's the car isn't doing it to me. It's just nothing. But by believing it's real, then I believe that that the car is annoying.
Okay, let's up the ante a bit. you want to go to sleep and have a restful sleep beside somewhere 10 feet away where they're running a backhoe and a jackhammer all night. What would you say about that? Is it affecting your experience? Is there a case that you could see where it wouldn't be affecting your experience? And you say, well, it's affecting the physiology. It's actually damaging my physiology. Could you see a case where it wouldn't be damaging your physiology? You may not have a choice. There's people all over the world that sleep by railroad tracks. There's people all over the world that sleep in cities, and they don't know that their fertility and their physiology is being totally altered by sleeping near roads. They think it's quite normal. It is normal, but it actually is deeply affects their physiology. It's been demonstrated in case over and over again.
If you were really, really, really tired, then you can probably just solve
code. Because people do.
Yeah.
Even the people running the backhoe and the jackhammer actually fall asleep.
Yeah,
but that's not really what I'm getting at. That's okay. Is it affecting you, or is it affecting the concepts? And if you're saying it affects the physiology, can you think of examples whereby changing your physiology, you actually change how the outer affects the inner? Can you think of that? Have you ever been really mad or irritated and someone gives you a hug and it all disappears?
Yeah.
Great. It is, but there's people who've reported many times that even in worse situations, bombs flying around, they've actually been felt really good. And it was one of the best times of their life, and they came out really well, and other people devastated for the rest of their life and have PTS for the rest of their life, can't get over it. Causes and conditions. Okay. Number 22. In terms of objects and subjects, okay, I'm going to back up again. Back up again, let's maybe want to write this down. Is the mind being changed, or is the physiology being changed? Is it the states that you're describing being altered, or are you describing the physiology that's altered and the interpretation of the states? And does the awareness actually change? So, here we go, into Chittamatra. Is the awareness changing, or are the states of experience changing in the field of unchanging awareness? This is what the Chittamatras are getting at. One very important point of penetrative insight. Are you mistaking the clouds for the sky? The sound of the generator right now has a certain beat to it. Jeff, what's the beat?
About 60 cycles.
Right. Okay, probably 60 cycles per second.
Actually, you're hearing 120 right now.
Okay, so you can feel that. Can all of you feel that? There's a beat to the generator. Yeah, there's a beat to the generator. It's very fast. Ever seen the refresh rate on a screen? Yeah, some people can't see that. Fortunately, I've always been able to. It kind of drives me. You know, you're looking at a computer screen like this. But we don't see that. Yes, you do.
Can I offer?
I'm just going somewhere with this. Where is that beat of the generator occurring? Is that beat discontinuous or continuous experience? In other words, while the beat is happening, or that you hear the generator, is there something else that's continuous? The awareness doesn't vary, the beat changes. The concept of the generator is changing all the time, but what actually is experiencing the generator? Make sense? Okay, I'll leave that with you because it's a very important point of Chittamatra, of penetrative vipassana. Number 22. So I've just introduced that and let that sink in a bit, if it will. Number 22, in terms of objects and subjects, or subjects and objects, whatever appears to the consciousness, apart from the cognitions themselves, no external objects exist anywhere. True or untrue? In terms of objects and subjects, whatever appears to the consciousness, apart from the cognitions themselves, the perceptions themselves, no external objects exist anywhere, and really best would be to put a comma to experience. Okay, is that true or untrue? And this is central to Chittamatra, to the great yogis of Chittamatra.
In terms of objects and subjects of consciousness, yes, this is true, but it doesn't prove that there is no external thing to be.
Great, great. Very good point. Can any of you prove that there's an external, a real external object?
But you can't disprove it either.
No, you can't.
You can't?
No, you can't.
Okay.
But by logic, actually, you can prove that there's no. I'll be very clear about this. There's no truly existing external object as the way you feel it is. That's the point they were making. And this is the stickiest point for human beings and causes immense suffering. No, the teacup is exactly as I perceive it. There's no teacup as you perceive it. One, there's no atoms truly existing, and there's no concept about the cup that will be the same from moment to moment.
Or for a different kind of being.
A potter doesn't have the same concept of the cup that you have. A physicist doesn't have the same concept. The chemist doesn't have the same concept. The biologist doesn't have the same concept. If you get into a room with ecologists, as I often do, boy, they don't have anything like the same concept. Just use the word outhouse these days. You know, most places you can't even build an outhouse anymore. You can't, BC, we can't build outhouses anymore. Not allowed to. Okay? Ecologically, it's too damaging in terms of the whole ecosystem. Is anything out there what it appears to be? So this is important because it has to do with your liberation. Is anything out there as it appears to be, or is it simply clinging to concepts about how it should be or it is?
I'm not really understanding the second part of this section.
Okay.
Apart from the
of this verse.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
Apart from the cognitions themselves, no external objects exist anywhere.
Okay. The cognitions themselves are the objects in the sense field. So he's still considering these to be real. As earth, water, fire, and air. So we have to go back to Abhidhamma. And this may be a little bit hard for you, but just follow along. That remember that the external so-called object is really, in fact, earth, water, fire, and air. It's not an external object. And according to ancient Buddhist philosophy, meditative practice, there really is an external thing. But in fact, it's earth, water, it's atoms, earth, water, well, it's not atoms, it's made of earth, water, fire, and air. So what he's going to do, you're going to see, is he's going to say, these are real, but in your experience it isn't. Then he's going to even take away the reality of those cognitions. So for right now, the cognition is a thing. But in your experience of your mind, there's no real thing. So even though there is a thing out here, let's do this, there is something. This is the thing about Chittamatriya, be careful about. It's not saying there isn't a world. It's just saying that the world that you experience is nothing like the world is. It's very important. So there is perceptual formations, but in your mind, it's nothing like it. Okay? So therefore, it says no. So if you add in one word, it should be now clear. No external objects truly exist anywhere. That's the key. Just if you write that in, he's implying, as he does in his longer text, no external objects truly exist anywhere. That's the important point. Just write in truly, and it all becomes very clear. The Chittamatrans never took the position that nothing doesn't exist. Nothing truly exists. You exist, but not truly. Are you okay with that? How do you feel about that emotionally? How do you feel? You do exist, yeah. Fantastic, eh? It's very liberating. For others, it's devastating. You know that, eh? For others, it's absolutely devastating. It hurts like hell. You exist, but you don't really exist. And you don't exist at all how you think you exist. You certainly don't exist that way to an ant. You don't exist that way to a tiger. You don't exist that way to a tree. You don't exist that way to any other life form, but a human being that has the same cultural upbringing. Isn't that cool? That's freedom. That's really glorious freedom, to have that being, whose glorious being, but actually it's unobstructed infinite dimensions, what it could be to even a human being. You ever have a partner? Anybody have a, you know, a wife, a partner, and you've looked at your partner and go, wow, do I know that person? Right? Or, wow, look what they are. That's so cool. Like you've never seen that before. Isn't that amazing? So, no external objects truly exist anywhere. What I want you to do today or tomorrow in the next year or two is feel how solid the clinging is to the external object as being a real, truly existing thing for you. That's where the suffering occurs. That's where the clinging occurs. That's where the fighting over how you cut up strawberries, or how you're going to pave the road exactly, or how many inches of this, or, right? The wars that happen because of an island somewhere truly existing, as if the island is going to make a shred of difference for humanity, yeah, but, which is what is happening in the China Sea right now, eh? Just like on the edge of a war over areas. You know what it is. It's called rare earth minerals and oil deposits underneath the surface. That's what it's about. Huge economic potential and fishing. Right. But is it going to really make a shred of difference for the future? No, not at all. So when we say, when we're in a philosophical university situation, we can say, well, you know, this isn't so important. But when it comes to dukkha of human beings, the absolute abject suffering and dukkha, this is number 22 is the key point. This is where the suffering occurs. That's my shirt and I want it back. And there's people that will kill over that. You should know that. I don't know if you're too innocent Canadians. That's my shirt. I want that shirt and I'm going to kill you for it. I remember once being told in Mozambique by a dear friend, if you go there, they will kill you for sure for $5. You're not going there. Shit. That's right. Once bribing a border patrol, on a road in Africa, with guns, you know, like this, in the middle of a road in Africa, we're driving, getting into a kind of a friendly talk, trying to figure out what they want. You know, you could end up in the bushes because nobody around. So we, you know, open up the trunk. And what was it? How did we get out of that? Each person got a carton of cigarettes. That did the trick. Life for a carton of cigarettes. Pretty good trade-off. Not bad. So what is it? Their experience is you're worth a carton of cigarettes. For a nice Canadian, how's that even possible? So when we talk about suffering, human beings suffer a lot. It's really crazy, eh? Carton of cigarettes for a life. Still going on today, don't think it isn't. That wasn't very long ago. Number 23. How are we doing for time? In a timeless universe. 23. So there are no external objects at all. Let's put in this word. Because it's very important in Chittamatra. So there are no real external objects at all. There are external objects. But they're not actually have any ultimate reality. That doesn't mean good or bad. It just means it's not actually how we can know it. And we have the same thing in science. Whenever we change our conceptual field in science, science makes a leap. It's fantastic. It's really enjoyable. to know that you're doing science and you're not really seeing the whole picture at all. But you're going to have to wait. And you're going to have to wait for data to come along before you change how you see the world. So right now we're living through an ecosystem, symbiotic world of biology. Everybody's into ecosystems and symbiotic relationships. It's also because we have the tools to do that now. So now we have the equipment to do that, so we're going to see it that way. Is it true? Not really ultimately, but it feels like it is. Existing in the mode of entities, so there are no real external objects at all, existing in the mode of entities, of real, lasting, permanent, definable entities. What is it that we suffer about? Real, definable concepts. We fight over it, we argue over it, we get head up about it, we exhibit greed, hatred, delusion, when in fact, no such thing has to happen. The very perceptions of the individual consciousness arise as appearances of the forms. There we go. All there. All is an interpretation of viewpoint and the instruments that create the viewpoint or interdependent with the viewpoint. The kind of instrument that you use is how you see. So right now, Laurel is looking through a visor. How she looks through a visor, the instrument, is also how the perceptions will be seen. Make sense? If you have cataracts, you see in a certain world. If you can't see 20/20 vision, if you have hearing damage and so on, that's how you see. How do you feel right now physically? Some of you I can see are physically uncomfortable, maybe time for a stretch. Therefore, that physiology will affect your nervous system, which will affect how you see and perceive and even your ideas. It's very hard to study Chittamatra when your body's in knots and feels very uncomfortable, isn't it? Everything feels very solid, and yet you're hearing things going, yeah, but my senses aren't really how I experience them. But that doesn't feel like it. So let's stand up and stretch for a few minutes. Take a stretch. Let's change the physiology. Are you all on? Yep, they disappeared on Zoom. Most of them all, except the ones that have like fixed pictures. No, they're still sitting. There's a few still sitting, but most of them have gotten up. I think they just went up and disappeared. Number 23 is the first major experience before the dawning of appearance emptiness. He's actually kind of putting his finger on the kind of experience that you will encounter when you're on the edge of experiencing the inseparability of mind and phenomena as an inseparable, unitive experience. And before it becomes the experience of emptiness appearance. So the last line there is that when you can stay with this contemplation, everything in experience, everything as appearance, is an arising of forms in the mind, arises appearances of the forms, not as the forms themselves, not as the forms themselves, but as appearances of the forms. So this key point here, this line, is what happens before the dawning of appearance emptiness experience. The perceptions appear dreamlike. The perceptions appear mirage-like. The perceptions lose their solidity. When you look at humans, it's not that the humans aren't there. They just don't have the same solidity. The walls don't feel solid. The floor is no longer solid. It's not disconcerting. It's not like a weirdo experience. It's not like on LSD. It's just absolutely clear experience. The solidity goes because the objects in consciousness are experienced exactly the way they are, appearances of the mind, just appearances, not real forms. Okay, number 24. Just as a person whose mind is deluded sees magical illusions and mirages and the cities of the Gandhara spirits, so too forms and so on are perceived. So, has anybody had experiences where, probably not like this because we're very Western, looking up into the sky and seeing clouds and going, look at that, there's a whole palace up there. That's what that's referring to. Or something's happening, I've seen that, people say, oh, well, look, the leaves are moving, I'm in a palace of some magical thing. So for the magician, the magical illusion is seen as an illusion. For the audience, it's seen as something very real. Yeah. Okay. So the place to come to is when you start to experience the misapprehension of things is a very beautiful thing. In other words, the naming of something is now clearly seen not to be the thing. Let me give an example. This is the kind of experience that will dawn. You look at a cup and you hear yourself having the concept of cup, naming cup, nama, and the form no longer matches the cup. It feels unreal. It feels like an imposter, like a put-on. So have you had that experience? And you've probably had that many times in your life, just didn't know what that was. You look at a tablecloth and you go, huh? You can do that with your name. Just try it. Say your name out loud. Just say your name out loud. Say your name. Mark. Mark. I'm sure you see that sometimes. You go, Mark. Bark. Nark. Wark. Bark. Rock. Sometimes I did that in class. Right. So the nama rupa, the naming and the form, is now seen to be something quite artificial and suspect. It's not that it's wrong, but it's not that it's right. Anybody get the feel for that? It's not quite right. Something's not quite right here. Yes?
So I can see how the name is made up. It's difficult to see that the form is made up as well.
Okay, let's do this. So-called being called Adam, what is it you're actually seeing? There. Say the word hand.
Well, it's not that, but hand.
What is it that you're actually seeing? What's the experience? Very good. Very, very good. Okay, you got it. You just don't know you got it. But it can't be explained. Why? Because the name, which is the concept which most people hold to as reality, no longer feels right. Are you getting a sense of that? It just isn't right anymore. The concept's like an echo. It isn't actually the thing. But for most human beings, 99.9%, the concept is the thing. Naming's magic. Names are magic. They're magic mantras. Right? They're magic mantras. Glasses are glasses. But when the magic, when the naming begins to separate off the form, this doesn't, it's preposterous. So we need to come out of the magic. We need to come out of the projection and the stories and the conceptual contrivances. And it is a stage of meditative experience. So too, forms or so on are perceived as magical illusions and mirages. Okay, but when there is delusion, the concept is considered to be real. The temple right now. Is the temple a temple or a meditation hall? Let's have a debate. What do you think? Should we call it a temple or should it be called a meditation hall? I know I saw some documents the other day, some legal documents. What was it called? A meeting building. Which one is it? Temple, meditation hall, meeting building, I think. Meeting building, something like that. I don't know, a legal document. Which one is it?
Depends on the function.
Yeah, but some people may actually be, that's a temple. I've had that debate. I've said, it's a meditation hall. It's not, it's a temple. You know, and I go, well, I prefer it be called a meditation hall. No, I wanted a temple. I don't know, it's just a mirage. You should see what happened when I said, you know, the building, really, the conclusion is the building should be completely torn down. No way, it's a sacred entity. Imagine bringing a contractor up to look at those. What are you saving it for? Are you kidding? You're mad. Are you kidding? You're mad to save it. Just tear it down. But there might be a reason to save it. Do you understand? There might be a very good reason, conceptually and spiritually and so on. So let's just bulldoze. You know, that problem with Pagoda and all those cracks and things like that, just take it down and build it again. Just bring in some Burmese Pagoda builders. Is that right? Yeah. Wouldn't you say that's pretty logical as a builder?
Well, yes.
Well, as yes. But actually not for the benefit, maybe, or compassion for other beings. Concepts. Okay, getting the hang of it? So too forms and so on are perceived but unreal. And this is what the Chittamatrans are saying is the heart of suffering. And we're going to go even further. The real heart of suffering is not knowing awareness, not knowing conditioned awareness. No, we don't care so much about conditioned awareness. That's a good stage. But unconditioned awareness is where we're getting at. If you can't recognize it, then you're always holding on to mirages and concepts. There's nothing wrong with holding on to a mirage or concept as long as you know it's a mirage or a concept. Otherwise, you're really in trouble. Okay? I plan to go a little further in the text today, but I think that is plenty because the next step is going after the Chittamatrans. All right? So the Chittamatrans were highly realized beings. They're incredible yogis. They're still recognized by many great Buddhist practitioners as unbelievably realized beings. Who had incredibly sharp minds, but and then Nargarjuna is going to even go after them as saying, "Yep, excellent, but a little provisional, folks." So I think that's a good place to end. And then also at the same time, he's going to start removing it. He's even going to go deeper into the Chittamatra points, and how deep these fellows and gals went in their realization. So that I think is a good place to end today. So here you've got a lot of meditative practice to do, and you need time, you need merit, you need clear mind, stable mind, and you need the guts and the wish to really challenge, not just intellectually, but challenge by sitting with allowing a cognition to soften and the exploration to deepen, and you'll see, it'll come. If you wish it, it will come. That's good. And of course, the initiation of the vase, or the initiation of the torma, if you could hold up the metal torma there, Travis, the initiation of the vase and torma is in Vajrayana the introduction to emptiness and appearance, using the deity as the method. Thank you. That's great. Using using the Yidam as the direct means to come to compassionate emptiness and appearance. Why the torma? Now this is a metal torma, but Travis, you could hold up a food torma. There's a central one there, Vajrasattva, holding up a food torma. This is a metal traveling torma that we can use for all the initiations. This one here is a barley torma. I suppose it may not be. It may be some other substance. It could be plastic. But why pick food as one of the great initiation symbols? Nutrient of what?
Nutriment
of what?
Of the teaching, of awareness.
Buddha activity. That's why it's so high. All beings live by food, but all beings awaken through the food of Dharma, of direct transmission, pith instructions. That's how we awaken. So we all want to be manifestations of food for other beings. Isn't that a wonderful thing to think that you're being trained to become food for other beings? Like fish food? You know, someone says, you know, if you practice Dharma, you know, Vajrayana, you know what's going to happen? You're going to become fish food for all sentient beings. They're all going to be nibbling off you for little bits of realization. Isn't that cool? So isn't that a bit of a heroic position to take? Here, you know, piranhas, come feed off me. That's exactly what it is. Not being scared to be food, Dharma food, for all beings. Torma. Namjoon Rinpoche used to give some of the most amazing teachings, just pithy teachings of Torma. Really, really something else. Well, let us finish today. Michael, if you could just lead us in English and Tibetan, a dedication aspiration. If you could do that, that would be great. I'm just going to sit back and listen. Thank you. Goodbye, all those on Zoom. Let us resume on Tuesday morning. And for the others, I'll ask. Let's see here. There's so many fine practitioners in this room. Could I ask Tracy? Do you have time tonight to lead a practice of Padmasapa? That'd be great. Skull Garland Lord, be wonderful. I'd like to give turns to everybody to practice. We'll see about that. To lead the group. And it's an excellent thing to do. And we'll see you later. See you on Tuesday morning.